It's 5:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll learn about a new app you can download on your smartphone that helps you track the amount of carbon you're saving when you replace your light bulbs or use a refillable water bottle.
But first, it is the Wisconsin Public Radio Spring Membership Drive. Chris Molina is with us in the studio. You count on WPR's Ideas Network for talk about issues that matter to you. And WPR counts on you to help keep these discussions on the air. You can make your donation at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
Last hour, we heard from 11 listeners. Thank you so much for those pledges. This hour, we're looking to hear from 10 listeners. Help us meet this goal right now by making a contribution at WPR.org or at 888-202-2552. And the programs you enjoy will be here every day on Wisconsin Public Radio, thanks to your supports.
On the Ideas Network, you hear from the person who wrote the bill, who wrote the book, who has that unique expertise. We're glad to seek these people out, get them on the show. We're privileged to do that, in fact, but it is your support that makes all of that possible. Make great radio happen right now with your pledge at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
And during this membership drive, you can get the new I Love WPR magnets when you give $60. That's $5 a month or more. Your donation supports the programs you count on, and you can get these cool magnets.
That's right. You get one large, one small magnet. You can put them on your car, maybe your fridge, wherever you like, and you'll be reminded of your love for Wisconsin Public Radio. Pledge now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
There's been a lot of news about the state budget, and as proposed, the budget puts state funding for Wisconsin public broadcasting at risk. You tell us that you value the lasting impact of public broadcasting programs, news, conversations, music, and even entertainment.
And that's why Wisconsin Public Broadcasting, including WPR, is working hard to address the budget challenges as the process goes forward. Meanwhile, listener support is more important than ever, so make your gift at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
And if you've never given to Wisconsin Public Radio before, but you look forward to listening to WPR every day, that's a sign that it's time to donate. It means that WPR is important to you.
And you're important to us because WPR is listener-supported radio. We count on financial support from people like you, people who rely on WPR to bring them something special every day. Your gift of $5 a month or whatever amount feels right to you and really makes a difference at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
We are looking for 10 pledges by the end of the hour, and we've got about 50 more minutes to get them. Your gift right now of any amount, say $5 a month, $10 a month, $15 a month, the important thing is that you make a contribution that works for you, and you do it at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
And this pledge drive, we're offering something special for you. You can show your support for WPR with those new I Love WPR magnets. Very useful, and they're yours for a pledge of $5 a month at $60 or more at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
If you're not already a sustaining member of Wisconsin Public Radio, become one right now. It's so easy to set up convenient ongoing monthly donations from your bank account or your credit card. You can do it at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
You can join Bonnie in Green Bay. She says, I love listening to WPR as I drive. I'm always learning and thinking as I drive. I wouldn't want to be without WPR. Well, who would want to be without WPR? That's you too. So make that pledge. Ensure the future health of WPR by making your pledge at WPR.org or by calling 888-202-2552.
Listeners provide the single biggest piece of our budget pie here at Wisconsin Public Radio. I've said it before and I'll say it again. You are the public in Wisconsin Public Radio. We could not do this without you. Programs like Central Time, The Joy Cardine Show, Kathleen Dunn, On Point, and so on and so on. We couldn't bring these programs to you without your support. You are the public in Wisconsin Public Radio. That's why we're asking you to give at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
And you know, pledge drives are an important time to hear from new members. So if you've never given before, why not make today the day that you become a WPR member? People find that once they pledge, they're going to keep on doing it because they feel good. You'll feel good when you take that step, that leap, to become a WPR member. You can do it at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
And ask for that really cool set of magnets with your pledge of $5 a month. That's only $60 for a year of listening to Wisconsin Public Radio guilt-free, and you get awesome magnets in the process. That's a great equation right there. Make your pledge right now at WPR.org or at 888-202-2552, and thanks.
And now a recently released smartphone app aims to help users cut back on their carbon and their water usage.
Nancy Wong, a professor of consumer science at UW-Madison, developed this app. It's called My Earth, along with members of the university's computer science department.
My Earth is set up like a diary where users can record different activities that help them save carbon units. The more carbon units a person saves, the further they're able to progress in the app.
Nancy Wong joins us now in the studio to tell us more about it. Nancy, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So why an app to help give people options on being more environmentally friendly?
I designed the app to be a behavioral aid to help people to be reminded of the little things that they can do in their daily lives to help reduce their carbon footprint.
So users try to save, as I understand it, carbon units while they're using My Earth. What is a carbon unit? How do we measure that?
Well, the carbon units are actually based on calculations that we glean from EPA regulations and various other sources of research that we were able to compile and translate that into tangible output that is actually relatable to the users, such as a growing iceberg or a growing forest.
So what kind of things do we do in our real life that we enter into our My Earth app to get points for, in a way?
Well, the app actually shows you a list of activities in your daily life that covers a wide range of activities, from your electricity usage to saving water to recycling and to changing a light bulb, for that matter, to help you to contribute to saving your carbon footprint.
And then what do we see? What happens on the screen to reward us for entering these activities?
Well, as you actually enter each of the... Well, first of all, they are a list of activities from which you could select to customize to your daily needs so that it would sort of fit in with your daily lifestyle. And then and each day, you can actually enter whether you have performed various activities that you have selected. And that basically would calculate your daily carbon savings for the day, and that result is aggregated in a graphic that is saving the bear. And the polar bear is actually at level zero. The polar bear would be perched on a sort of like almost melting iceberg. And as you reduce your carbon footprint, the iceberg is going to grow organically, so thus making the results motivating to the user.
And what have you heard from people who have used it? Do they feel motivated? Do they take more of these little activities so that they can keep leveling up and building that iceberg?
Oh, absolutely. Because I've actually seen reviews given by users on the app that says that they received that information about that based on the write-up that he or she read on the Time magazine that actually gave this particular coverage. And so he downloaded the app and tried it, and he loved the computer graphics because he thought that was, most people actually find that drawing really cute and appealing and in a way that is relatable to themselves.
So do these little things that everyday people do really make a difference when it comes to overall global carbon output?
Absolutely, because to date, I think what has been encouraging is that we have over 1,000 users globally, and we can actually monitor their carbon savings. We have actually generated about 2.5 tons of carbon savings to date. Mm. So I would really like to put a word out there to get people to download the app and use it, because I think every little step that we collectively take would make a huge difference.
Are you trying to change a mindset from thinking of environmental responsibility as kind of a chore, you know, work to do, to make it something fun to participate in?
No, I like to make it fun to participate in and to actually not to underestimate the huge impact that we individually can make.
Now, you described how it works. Now, I understand you're in the as apps often are, you're in the process of revising and adding to it. So what's next? What are the next steps we're going to see on My Earth?
Oh, the next step is you're going to see a new range of graphics. So again, so you can actually have the display using the polar bear or a forest woodsy display so that, you know, they are different themes that could appeal to different users that I hope would continue to engage our users to try things out. And also, the longer term, it's not going to happen right away, is to have it being social media enabled.
So we could compete with our friends then?
Absolutely.
To see who has the biggest iceberg or the fanciest forest?
Yes, and then we could actually, you know, compare ourselves to the average users to see how you perform compared to the other users on using the app as well.
So we've got your phone here. Do you use the app? Are you using My Earth on a daily basis?
Yes, I do, of course. And then, you know, I look at the progress of how many users have downloaded the app, and then I'm always reminded of the fact that I have to do this again.
And what, are you at a high level now? Are you doing well at My Earth?
I would like to think so. I'm actually at level 5 right now.
How high a level can you get to on it?
You can get to at 7, level 7.
Okay, so you're working your way up there. Mm-hmm. Where can people get My Earth? How can people find it?
They can find it on the iOS Apple App Store as well as Google Play. They are available on both sites and it's free. And I would like to actually remind them that My Earth is spelled without a space mm-hmm. in between. And there is a tagline that is called Track My Carbon Savings.
All right. Nancy, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Nancy Wong, professor of consumer science in the UW School of Human Ecology, discussing how her My Earth app helps people live more energy efficient lives. The Milwaukee Bucks prepare to host another NBA playoff game tonight. Fans of the team are finding lots of reasons for optimism. Some of the younger players have driven up excitement, and the new Bucks owners want to build a new arena to showcase that team.
Based on comments from government leaders, an arena deal might be announced any day now. And we want to hear what you think. Should the state help fund the Bucks Stadium project? And if so, how much help should taxpayers give? You can call right now at 800-642-1234 is the number to call. That's 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll take your calls after a look at the latest news on the arena negotiations from WPR's Sean Johnson.
At the Bucks' first home playoff game last week, Bucks fan Nick Williams is excited about the prospect of a new arena. The Madison resident and Milwaukee native thinks the state ought to pay for it.
I mean, this is something tangible we can see, something that will help the community, create jobs, so I think I'm all for it. I like it.
Bucks fan Jim Smith likes the idea of a new arena, too. But the Waukesha County resident says the state's already offering enough money for an arena.
The state's ready, you know, ready and willing, and I think they're just waiting for the city and the county to step up to the plate, contribute a little bit more.
Conspicuously absent from those comments and from most of the political debate over the Bucks is any suggestion that the team's owners should pay more. Milwaukee Alderman Bob Bauman represents the district where the Bucks arena would be built.
It's really kind of breathtaking because there's just an assumption out there that, well, of course we have to pay 50% of this cost. That's just an assumption. And I wonder, why is that assumed?
While the details of the arena deal are still being negotiated, here's what was being discussed. The new Bucks owners, two of whom made Forbes' list of the wealthiest Americans, would pay a total of $150 million. Former owner Herb Cole would pay $100 million of his own. That would leave the state of Wisconsin, the city of Milwaukee, and Milwaukee County on the hook for $250 million. They could try banding together to demand more from the owners, but Bauman says he's confident the strategy would fail and the Bucks would leave town.
We're in an industry that can demand public subsidies if you, the public, want to retain this franchise. Others are willing to offer us public incentives to move. We'll take them. We really can legally extort money from you. It's a question of whether you want to be extorted or not.
Bauman says there's only so much the city can contribute, and state legislators say their constituents are wary of spending state money on the Bucks. Spring Green Republican Senator Howard Markline says there's no push for it in his district.
People are quite ambivalent on the whole issue, and I don't think they want any taxpayer money going to support a stadium.
Backers of the new Bucks Arena say the project is worthy of public dollars because it would boost the state's economy. University of Maryland economics professor Dennis Coates, who studies the economic effects of sports teams, says that's contrary to what research shows.
You can't legislate this. Either it does or it doesn't, and there's evidence on this.
Coates says there is a public benefit to the Bucks if the team makes people happy.
The difficulty with it is that because we have such a difficult time putting a value to that happiness, that improvement in the quality of life, we don't know if we're getting a good deal or getting a bad deal.
Coach says the contribution Bucks owners have pledged toward this arena is actually larger than in other cities. He also says the threat to leave without a public subsidy is likely very real. When it comes to negotiating sports arenas, Coates says owners have a captive audience, and they know it. Sean Johnson, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Now, you can share your thoughts at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. How do you think the new arena should be funded? How much should a government put in? The state, the county, the city? Would a funding plan you're not a fan of make you think differently about leaders who committed to it, the governor, the mayor, others? Call now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we're going to go first to Aaron joining us in Superior. Hi, Aaron.
Hi there. My comment is that, I'd be interested to see an economic impact analysis of this. I think sports stadiums are really notorious for over-promising and under-delivering. It's really an inefficient and ineffective use of state funds. You know, there's really a very small subset of the state and a small subset of Milwaukee that actually benefit from this. You know, the jobs created will be short-term. The long-term jobs they do create will be service sector, low-paying. So I think, especially in a city like Milwaukee with so many problems, there are a lot more effective places to invest public funds.
All right. Thank you so much for your thoughts, Aaron.
You can join in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page where Jennifer says perhaps the state should focus on the important issues such as elder care, how cutting family care and home care programs will affect the state's population, let basketball fans build a stadium, and let the state build a healthy population. Jennifer, thanks for sharing your thoughts there.
We go next to Adam joining us in Winona, Minnesota. Adam, hi.
Hi. I think it's a very interesting fact. You're basically putting the question of, we have money, and what are we putting it towards? And it seems like people are more focused on sports than other issues such as healthcare and education.
So you'd like to see this any funding that was raised directed elsewhere?
Yeah, absolutely. I think our priorities are completely skewed.
All right, Adam, thank you so much for your thoughts.
We'll go next to Mary Jo with us in Milwaukee. Mary Jo, hi.
Hi. Well, I think we should go either one way or the other. Either it's privatized and whoever, whatever private company pays to build it keeps the profits, or it should be publicly owned and we all get free tickets.
Something along, except for the free tickets, something along the lines of the Packers, you're thinking?
Well, I guess. Uh-huh. You know, I think that those, why should we taxpayers subsidize something that, you know, I with the last caller, I don't see the big benefit that we're getting out of it. It makes a few low-paying jobs, but I'd say let's try privatizing it for 5 years, and if they don't want to build it, it's obvious that because they're not going to make a profit, so why should we subsidize it?
Mary Jo, thanks for the call. You can keep sharing your thoughts on how to pay for a Bucks Arena, whether public funding should be involved, over at the Central Time Facebook page.
Blue Men and River Monsters. According to a new compilation of centuries-old folklore of the North, Wisconsin had both of those creatures in abundance.
Wisconsin's lakes and waterways may inspire poets and writers, but in previous centuries it also captured the imagination of settlers who wove stories around the creatures that might lurk beneath those watery surfaces.
Not just for fireside storytelling, these old tales and legends shed light on Wisconsin's culture and a way of life going back a century. Joining us now is John Zim, associate editor at the Wisconsin Historical Press and editor of Blue Men and River Monsters, Folklore of the North. John, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, your book, Blue Men and River Monsters, the material in this book actually had its origins way back in the Great Depression with something called the Works Progress Administration. Can you tell us a little bit of the origin story here and how that came into play?
Sure. In the midst of the Great Depression, as Franklin Roosevelt and his brain trust tried to come up with ways to give jobs to people. One of the ideas was to create projects for writers and artists. And as part of the Works Progress Administration, the federal government also created the Federal Writers Project and the Federal Arts Project as well. So basically with the idea that offices in each state would create a guidebook to create automobile tours with some local flavor, you know, interesting underneath the surface information about communities. And yeah, so this was in the summer of 1935. And in Wisconsin, I think by the spring of the next year, about 140 people were working in offices, collecting stories and, you know, trying to create this massive guidebook.
And you've got it divided up into three different categories: myths and legends, local history, and daily life and customs. Want to tell us a little bit about what you find in each one of these sections of the book?
Yeah, I think the book really takes us from, you know, the world of the imagination to in the myths and legends section, we find some pretty interesting stories about mythical beings and creatures, elves, blue men, and impossibly large sturgeon. And then the second section really deals with local history, with a lot of, you know, kind of interesting, surprising nuggets that maybe wouldn't normally make it into history books. You know, stories about counterfeiters and you know, mayhem and adventure. And then the third section is about the things that maybe sometimes we take for granted, you know, what we wear and how we eat, and how people made their daily life, you know, both in Wisconsin and in the old world. A lot of the stories were imported from Europe as well.
So these people who were collecting these stories and folktales back in the 30s, were they really just, you know, pounding the pavement, talking to local people?
That was the idea. The workers had a lot of resistance. You know, people were maybe a little suspicious of you know, people coming around asking too many questions. But the workers covered thousands of miles, drove around the state, and really relied on some of the relationships that workers had developed before the project. You know, people that they knew and could tell them about other people.
It's a fascinating history, and I want to start out with blue men from the title of your book. So there were little blue men, reportedly. I assume they were men here in Wisconsin. Tell us about some of the stories you collected or you've got here in this book.
Well, the blue men were, I guess they were a type of fairy that they wouldn't hurt humans unless harm themselves, but they did go around kidnapping pretty girls and forcing them to marry them. And the story that we have in the book is a pretty dramatic tale about a girl who was under some kind of trance with this blue man, but a chivalrous fellow shoots a silver button over the head of the blue man to break the spell. So that's a story that was imported here from Norway, I believe.
It's an interesting one, especially the fact that apparently back in these days, the local men would carry silver bullets and silver buttons just for this occasion.
Apparently so.
And they worked.
Right.
And what, in terms of myths, river monsters, water monsters seem to figure prominently. Why is that?
Wisconsin is covered by so much water, you know, so many lakes and rivers, and there was really a nice selection of accounts from different bodies of water in Wisconsin. You know, one of my favorites was the Terror of the Rock that apparently haunted the Rock River all the way to Lake Koshkonong, eating deer and terrorizing the population.
And what happened to that monster? Is it supposed to still be there?
Well, you know, apparently only a few people ever saw the water monster, but according to the account that we have in the book, it's pretty ambiguous about whether or not it's still there. But no, I'm guessing nobody has seen it for quite some time.
Well, moving on to the local history section, this is fascinating, too. You've got some collected stories, snippets about Wisconsin notables, including Nelson Dewey and John Muir. Do you remember any sort of particular nuggets that stand out from their lives?
Yeah, Nelson Dewey, there was actually a great amount of material collected that didn't make it into the book, because mostly what people were telling about Nelson Dewey were lists of possessions of his that they could remember. But you know, the account that we do have about Nelson Dewey is fairly sad, noting that his beloved mansion in Cassville burned down, and that by the end of his life he was a fairly anonymous fellow who, you know, at one time was a popular political figure, you know, serving as governor of Wisconsin. And John Muir, there are quite a few tales, as we would expect from somebody so memorable as John Muir. But the one thing that sticks out in my mind is how, as a child, John Muir invented locks for the buildings at the farm where he lived that only he could open. And there's a story about a party of people out trying to escape a rainstorm, and they couldn't get into the barn because they couldn't figure out John Muir's lock.
There's also a lot of folk wisdom, folk remedies in here. Can you share any from that section?
Yeah, apparently goat's milk seems to have been a good remedy. And elderberry blossom tea. You know, one of the kind of interesting things is some of the recipes that we find for, you know, Swedish wine. Apparently, I wouldn't recommend making this or trying it, but there's a recipe in here for dandelion wine, calling for 3 gallons of flowers and 5 gallons of water.
And you've tried this yourself?
Oh, no. Yeah. No, I wouldn't recommend it. Maybe it's fine.
And we also get in touch with some local places that we might see in a new way after having read this book. One is called Rainbow Falls. Why don't we wrap up having you tell us a little bit about Rainbow Falls?
Yeah, apparently Rainbow Falls is this very quiet, peaceful falls located someplace off of Highway 47 around Neopit. It's in the northern part of the state. And it sounds like it was quite memorable because people would come from, you know, various and sundry places to sit quietly and listen. And there was a legend that the rainbow was one of the great spirits talking waters and had a message for people, and that they knew it and that they needed it.
A special place to Native Americans.
It was. It was.
And John, what did the process of researching and collecting these stories mean to you personally?
When I was working on this, I actually thought a lot about my stepfather. He was a farmer in northern Wisconsin, and he had his own batch of stories that he would tell about his younger days. And I thought a lot about how he would talk to us about, you know, these friends of his who were trying to avoid the sheriff when driving home one night and took a little back road that was starting to grow over with trees. And the punchline of that story was that one of his friends said, "Put on plenty of speed, the trees are getting bigger." So, you know, that phrase really took on a life of its own in our house. If we were going someplace and we were late, you know, we'd hear someone say, "You know, put on plenty of speed, the trees are getting bigger." And, you know, he told so many stories, most of which are gone now. It would have been so easy just to record them or write down some of what he said. So, you know, this book is really for people like my stepfather whose stories are gone. You know, we really see this as a tribute to people who go under the radar maybe sometimes and whose lives are really enriched by stories like, you know, put on plenty of speed or, you know, accounts about Rainbow Falls.
John, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
That was John Zim, associate editor at the Wisconsin Historical Press and the editor of Blue Men and River Monsters, Folklore of the North.
Now, Chris Molina joins us here in the studio. This is the Wisconsin Public Radio Spring Membership Drive. Your support is an essential piece of the funding for all the programs you enjoy on WPR Central Time and the whole rest of the shebang there. This drive is the time for you to take action. Become a WPR member with your gift at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
And some great news to report. We've heard from 11 listeners this hour. We had a goal of 10. We've got 11. Keep those pledges coming. Make your gift to support the station you love.
We want to say thank you so much if you've already given. But if you haven't, you can help us stay on track by making your contribution right now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
We just got an interesting look at legends from Wisconsin's history. It's the kind of unique take on Wisconsin that we try to bring you here on Central Time every day in the Wisconsin Life segments, unique perspectives on Wisconsin's past and present.
Yeah, we love finding these unique stories from all around the state, whether they be past, present, or future. And, you know, it's your support that makes these stories, these topics that we cover every day on the show possible. That's why we're asking you to choose a gift amount that works for you, maybe $5 a month or $15 a month, and then make your pledge at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.